Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. Professor Stephen Batchelor, director of Sharpen Buddhist College in England, addressed a Trinity College audience on negative capability, emptiness, Nagarjuna, and Keats on April 11th, 2000. Professor Batchelor is introduced by Professor Ellison Findlay.
And he has come to us from Devon, England. And there he holds three separate but probably interrelated offices. He is director of studies at Sharpen College. He is a guiding teacher at Gaia House. And he is a Buddhist prison chaplain at the local NIC. All of these offices that he's holding are soon to be renounced, I understand, because he's retiring to France to be a freelance intellectual with his wife. Stephen was ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist monk in 1974, and for the next 6 years he trained in India, Switzerland, and Germany. In 1980, he went to South Korea, and he lived there as a Buddhist monk for 4 years. Stephen then came back to England in 1985 and settled at Sharpen, which was then a lay Buddhist community. And in 1996, he founded the Sharpen College for Buddhist Studies and Contemporary Inquiry. He has an enormous number of publications, and I'm simply going to read the major books. And three of them are here. One of them didn't come. The Awakening of the West did not come. And at the end of the talk, I'm going to sit up here and take money for the books, and especially for the new one. In 1979, he published a translation of Shantideva's A Guide to the Buddhist Way of Life. Bodhisattva Way of Life. Yes, you're right. In 1983, Alone with Others, which we have here. In 1988, The Tibet Guide, or A Tibet Guide, or Tibet Guide, which...
The Tibet Guide,
which has gone through a number of revisions. In 1990, The Faith to Doubt. In 1994, The Awakening of the West, which we ordered but is not here. In 1997, Buddhism Without Beliefs, which is here. And in 2000, Verses from the Center, which is here. So we would like to welcome him very much. He is going to speak this afternoon on negative capability, emptiness, Nagarjuna, and Keats.
I would like to start by reading the passage from Nagarjuna's Mulamadhyamaka Karika, which henceforth I'll just call Verses from the Center, which, as most of you are probably aware, is one of the most seminal texts in the Buddhist tradition as a whole. I suppose really what marks it out as distinctive is that it's the first time after the historical Buddha Gautama that the Buddhist tradition, as it were, finds itself articulated in a highly distinctive voice. Until the time of Nagarjuna, the Buddhist community had satisfied itself through remembering what the Buddha had taught, studying the discourses, the suttas, the Vinaya, and so on, and also had begun to systematize and classify the Buddha's language into what's called the Abhidhamma, which we might translate as kind of encyclopedia, lots of cross-referencing, taxonomies, definitions, and so on, and had also begun to develop early what we might call metaphysical or proto-philosophical systems of thought. But with Nagarjuna, there is, as it were, a very kind of abrupt signaling that something else is going on. And we find in the Verses from the Center the first attempt to give voice to the Buddha's teaching that does not reiterate what the Buddha's already said. In fact, there's only one explicit reference to any Buddhist text or sutra in the whole of the Verses from the Center, nor is it an attempt, as it were, to codify in some systematic way the teaching of the Buddha. That was really a process that developed after Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna really stands as a kind of liminal figure. In other words, someone who is in between the early period of Buddhism, of the sutras and the Abhidhamma and so on, and the later traditions of Buddhism, which broadly speaking we can put under the rubric of Mahayana, in which a whole new literature and culture, an interest in epistemology, in logic, in philosophy developed and became highly systematized, highly refined. Nagarjuna fits neatly into neither camp. And this is perhaps what I find so particularly compelling about him. He has, of course, been both rejected by the earlier schools, the Theravada and the schools sometimes loosely called Hinayana, who see him as really a figure of no interest, as someone who's gone off somewhere else. And at the same time, he has been co-opted or taken on board as a kind of founding father of the later traditions, the Mahayana. And in fact, in most Mahayana traditions, you'll find Nagarjuna is placed as one of the earlier or earliest patriarchs or founders or lineage holders of that tradition. But the curious thing is that in Nagarjuna's own writing, and here I specifically refer to the verses from the center, his major work, there is no mention or reference to anything distinctively Mahayana. There's no mention of the Bodhisattva, there's no mention of the Bodhicitta, there is no mention of the Bodhisattva path. In fact, when Nagarjuna speaks of the path to enlightenment, he speaks quite openly in terms of the early tradition of the Arhat and the Shravaka and so on. So Nagarjuna doesn't, on the internal evidence of his own work, Nagarjuna can neither be reduced to the early tradition, nor can he be subsumed within the later Mahayana doctrines. He's a figure who stands between, as I've already mentioned, these two major movements within the Buddhist tradition. It's like a kind of an opening, I feel. I feel there's a freshness in Nagarjuna's work, and I will in fact read some, maybe one or two of the poems that I've translated, just to give you a sense of that, at least in my understanding. But I'd like to start by reading just a few lines from the opening of the longest chapter in Verses from the Center, which is called Awakening. The formal title is Analysis of the Four Truths. I think Awakening captures it rather better. So this is my rendition of a very key passage. The Dharma taught by Buddhas hinges on two truths, partial truths of the world and truths which are sublime. Without knowing how they differ, you cannot know the deep. Without relying on conventions, you cannot disclose the sublime. Without intuiting the sublime, you cannot experience freedom. I'll read that again. The sequence of ideas is kind of important, I think. The Dharma taught by Buddhas hinges on two truths, partial truths of the world and truths which are sublime. Without knowing how they differ, you cannot know the deep. Without relying on conventions, you cannot disclose the sublime. Without intuiting the sublime, you cannot experience freedom. Now, for those of you who are familiar with classical Buddhist text, you might be wondering what on earth this term sublime is doing in here. And if you were to compare this with other translations, you will find, of course, no mention of such a term. You'll find instead words like the ultimate, the absolute. The term in the original Sanskrit is paramata satya, which is almost invariably translated as ultimate truth, absolute truth. Now, there is, of course, a perfectly legitimate reason for doing that, and in many ways that's quite an adequate translation. But the problem with it is that it assumes that Nagarjuna's writing is primarily concerned about philosophical matters, matters of ultimacy, what is ultimately the case with reality, the absolute, and so on, which I feel are terms which in some ways sit very uneasily with the rather ironic and iconoclastic thrust of Nagarjuna's own work. It has been assumed by both Buddhist tradition and Western scholarship that has in some respects followed the assumptions of Buddhist tradition that Nagarjuna is a kind of philosopher, a proto-Madhyamaka or founder of the Madhyamaka system of philosophy, and consequently he has been understood as primarily being concerned with the with a kind of dialectical kind of reasoning that refutes certain false positions and opens up a sense of the middle way of shunyata, of emptiness. One can certainly read the text in that way. But I find somehow that in doing so, one loses another dimension of the text, which I feel is more appropriately represented in a poetic language. And what I've chosen to do in this translation is to render Nagarjuna as a poet rather than a philosopher. There is, of course, a high philosophical component even of the poems, but nonetheless, in framing him, as I was saying this morning, as a poet, then one, as it were, configures the text in such a way that leads to a rather different reading. Now, this process has led me to explore the possibilities of translating quite well-known and classical terms in another light. And an example of this is, in fact, my choice of the term sublime for ultimate. Now, I think the word sublime, except for those of you who are, you know, are familiar with its traditional meanings, is a word that's become rather debased in our culture. We tend to use it, since I've been working on this, I pay attention to how the word is used in, say, the popular media and so on. In England, I've noticed it's a term of choice amongst football commentators at the moment, that if a particular soccer player displays certain skills, he's described as exhibiting sublime movements of the foot, or whatever phrase. The word crops up again and again and again and again, usually as a rather kind of precious kind of beauty, skill, or something like that. So I'd like to explore here the more traditional meaning of the way in which the sublime has been understood in the West, and this, I think, will give us an opening into how it may be an appropriate term for translating the Sanskrit paramata, which is usually rendered as ultimate or absolute. Now, the notion of the sublime in the West has its beginnings with a second century work by a Greek, I think Greek, I'm not sure actually, Longinus, I don't know how you pronounce it, who wrote a treatise on the sublime in about the 3rd century. And for this writer, the sublime referred to that which was the highest, the greatest good, the most elevated value or idea that the human being could aspire to. It suggested elevation and truth and all of those things. Now, this, of course, captures something of the notion of paramata, of what's usually translated as the ultimate. This is the sort of the highest truth. I mean, that's one way in which I think Geoffrey Hopkins has translated it. There is a sense that it represents the apogee, the pinnacle of what a human being can aspire to and hopefully realize. But the term became effectively marginalized, forgotten, I guess, until the 18th century, when it was resurrected both by the Irish philosopher and politician, statesman Edmund Burke, in his essay on the sublime and the beautiful, which was published in 1759. And Burke, as it were, really brought the term back into some kind of currency, at least amongst intellectuals and so on. And for Burke, the sublime represented, as it were, that which is beyond the grasp of reason, beyond the grasp of the ordinary, everyday conceptual mind. It is really, well, he speaks very much of the emotion of the sublime, the feeling of the sublime, which is, for example, illustrated by Burke by our sense, for example, of the ocean. He also gives an example, snakes, which in my experience, in my work here, have again a rather peculiar resonance with Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna, mythologically, being the figure who retrieved the perfection of wisdom discourses from the bottom of the ocean, from the bottom of the sea. And also, Nagarjuna, Naga, means snake or serpent. Nagarjuna is very much associated with the Nagas, the snake culture, which is a deep-rooted Indian kind of tonic religious idea. The earliest temples in India, I believe, are probably of the Naga cult. So Nagarjuna, I think, we can also see as tapping into a depth within Indian spirituality that is reflected in his appropriation of this term Naga, snake. And again, as I mentioned this morning, quite strikingly, he compares emptiness to a snake. He says that the emptiness will can injure the unintelligent in the same way as one can be harmed by the mishandling of a snake. So we get senses here, admittedly associative senses of something kind of both awesome in a way, and at the same time rather fascinating and terrifying. And these really are the two qualities that Burke is concerned with. On the one hand, the sublime is that which evokes a feeling both of fascination and of terror. It's something that the mind cannot contain. There's something excessive about the sublime. It cannot be reduced. It somehow overwhelms us. It gives us a sense of the sheer enormity and power of the world in which we find ourselves to exist. And it was this element that was picked up by Immanuel Kant in his critique of aesthetic judgment towards the end of the 18th century, I think it was 1797 or something, in which this work was published, in which Kant speaks of what he calls the mathematical and the dynamic sublime. And the mathematical sublime, which again sounds rather sort of abstract and uninteresting, refers to the sublime as in this sense of magnitude, vastness, enormity. And the dynamic sublime refers to this sense of power, of force, this terrifying, fascinating power that brings the world into being. Now, we find Burke and Kant, but particularly Burke, of considerable influence on the English Romantic poets, starting with Wordsworth and then Coleridge, going through Shelley, Keats, or those four primarily, who discussed at length this notion of the sublime. I'm going to read you a piece that's actually quoted in the book, but I've got it here on a piece of paper, so it's easier. This is Coleridge. Just to give you a sense of how this term was used. This is a passage from Coleridge's diary he kept in Germany in 1799 when he was on a walking trip or somewhere there, something there. And he describes how he lay awake at night listening, quote, to the thunders and howling of the breaking ice, which led him to reflect that there are sounds more sublime than any sight can be, more absolutely suspending the power of comparison, and more utterly absorbing the mind's self-consciousness in its total attention to the object working on it. Now that I found a very, very intriguing passage. It it also brings up his notion of how the sublime, or the feeling or the emotion of the sublime, is characterized by what he calls the suspension of the power of comparison. Suspension of the power of comparison. There's another passage in the recent biography of Coleridge in which he's spoken of having a conversation with some German intellectuals on a walking tour, and they're trying to define the sublime, and they all agree at the end that Coleridge's definition of the suspension of the act of comparison is the notion that captures it most readily. And this becomes, for Coleridge in other writings, tantamount to what constitutes the potency of the imagination and the whole creative process. Now, this sounds very strange, perhaps, to some of us. The idea that that the imagination, the creative, awake sense of the world that we associate with the poet, had something to do with a suspension. And for a Buddhist audience listening to this, they might be quite surprised to hear in this expression a very strange intimation of the letting go of dualism, the suspending of the power of comparison, of the tendency of the mind to try to make sense of the world by constructing it in terms of opposites, into this or that, self and other, yes and no, being, non-being, precisely all of the opposites of the dualities that Nagarjuna particularly, but the Buddha as well, sought to steer their middle way. So we have here perhaps a clue that the kind of imaginative work that we find Coleridge and Keats and these others striving to achieve involves processes which are not entirely dissimilar, at least in their outward expression, from the ways in which Buddhists have talked about the experience of emptiness. We will come back to that. Well, maybe we won't. Let's just go straight on into Keats. Now, perhaps the most well-known and perhaps the most obvious parallel here is with Keats' famous idea of negative capability, the title of this the title of this lecture. So let's actually read the passage in which Keats introduces the idea of negative capability. It's from a letter of December 1817. He says, I had not a dispute, but a disquisition with Dilke, one of his friends, upon various subjects. Several things dovetailed in my mind, and at once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement, especially in literature, and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean, negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after facts or reasons. So that's the definition. When a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after facts or reason. Now, when I first read that, and again, there's a story behind that, while I was working on this translation, I was given a book by an American Zen teacher called John Tarrant, I think. And I was flicking through it, and I stumbled across Keats, and I just looked at this definition of negative capability that he had quoted. And I'd not read it before, or at least not consciously remembered having read it. And what struck me so enormously about it was how that definition could serve as an almost exact description of a kind of Zen meditation that I practiced in Korea for 3.5 years and subsequently have held as the core of my own Buddhist practice. Now, this practice is one in which one focuses the attention on a question, simply the question, what is this? And we would sit for long hours during long retreats in a darkened room, just asking ourselves, what is this? What is this? And trying not to sort of get... Well, after a while, of course, what happens is that the intellectual mind just kind of gives up. You keep returning to this question. Even if you think you've got an answer, then the question will become, well, what is it that thinks it's got an answer? In other words, you always turn the whatever answer or perception or intuition or feeling you have, and you then bring that back into the domain of inquiry, of questioning, in such a way that one begins to value precisely what Keats values, and that is the capability of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact or reason. That is exactly what Zen practice, or at least the kind that I was taught, is about. Now, we find, therefore, that this quality echoes once again Coleridge's idea of a suspension of the act of comparison, which I think probably does inform this idea to some extent. In fact, we have a passage from Coleridge himself in which he speaks about negative belief in a somewhat different context. Also remember that this expression we hear so much nowadays, the willing suspension of disbelief, this was coined by Coleridge around this same time, but that was in a somewhat different context. So we have with Keats, I think, one of the clearest statements of what he saw as lying at the heart of his creative and imaginative process. But I'd like to link that in with other passages which tie this in with the sense of the sublime. Now, Keats, unlike Coleridge, does not actually write in his letters to any great extent about the sublime. There is a passage which I will read out later. But I'd like to look at some of the poems themselves to get a sense of how, for Keats, this sense of the sublime, let's say, is crucial to his whole imaginative and creative project. This is from his early poem, Asleep and Poetry. And I'm just going to read this first passage, both because I think it, again, has extraordinarily Buddhist resonances, but also because I think it does catch the sort of sense of sublimity that I feel Nagarjuna likewise is, as it were, concerned with. Stop and consider, life is but a day, a fragile dewdrop on its perilous way from a tree's summit. A poor Indian sleep while his boat hastens to the monstrous steep of Montmorency. Why so sad a moan? Life is the rose's hope while yet unblown, the reading of an ever-changing tale, the light uplifting of a maiden's veil, a pigeon tumbling in clear summer air, a laughing schoolboy without grief or care, riding the springy branches of an elm. Now, what's so striking about that is, on the one hand, this acute sense of transiency, this acute sense of life's ephemerality, this sense of life as being an irresistible movement towards its own end. And then this pause and this question, well, why should that make us so sad? And then another sudden twist and a reflection on life as being impermanent, changing, tragic in a way, and yet evocative of something so uncapturable in language that Keats simply lists, as it were, a sequence of images which are extraordinarily potent, such as a pigeon tumbling in clear summer air, that both evoke something that is extraordinarily familiar and yet in the language itself somehow points to something infinitely beyond what is simply graspable in those words. Keats goes on, and can I ever bid these joys farewell? Yes, I must pass them for a nobler life, where I may find the agonies, the strife of human hearts. There's always this movement in Keats to, in a sense, resist the allure of the merely delightful and attractive and beautiful, and to turn to that which is painful, which is, in a sense, almost suffocating in its tragic nature, which again, of course, reminds us very much of the Buddhist preoccupation as well. He then speaks of here, "Yet there ever rolls a vast idea before me, and I glean therefrom my liberty. Thence too I've seen the end and aim of poesy." So this notion of a vast idea. This is Keats at a fairly young age in his poetic, his very short-lived poetic career, trying to make sense of what it is that he is moving towards, what his life is unfolding into. Again, this sense of vastness, a vast idea rolls before me, and I glean therefrom my liberty. I mean, this is very reminiscent of this passage of Nagarjuna, "Without intuiting the sublime, you cannot experience freedom." There's something linked here between this sense of vastness, of sublimity, that is at the same time as being fascinating and terrifying, is also that which seems to lie in some very difficult to describe way at the very heart of what human beings experience as freedom. And another metaphor he uses, "An ocean dim, sprinkled with many an isle, spreads awfully before me. How much toil." We find even stronger images here. This is in his epistle to Reynolds. "I was at home and should have been most happy, but I saw too far into the sea, where every more the greater on the less feeds evermore. But I saw too distinct into the core of an eternal, fierce destruction, and so from happiness I far was gone. Still am I sick of it, and though today I've gathered young spring leaves and flowers gay of periwinkle and wild strawberry, still do I that most fierce destruction see, the shark at savage prey, the hawk at pounce, the gentle robin, like a pard or ounce, ravening a worm." So you have here very much the classic romantic sense of the sublime. Now, it seems to me that these two ideas, on the one hand of negative capability, this suspension of reason and fact and so on and so forth, and on the other hand this evocation of something sublime, go very much hand in hand. The question I think perhaps many of us might feel, if we're thinking of this in terms of a Buddhist context, is to where do we find these kinds of ideas of vastness and sublimity and the inability to actually encompass something with the mind in Buddhism itself? Where do we find a Buddhist sublime? I would argue that perhaps the most poignant moment in which such a sense seems to emerge in the Buddhist tradition is right at the very beginning, in the legend of the Buddha himself, the young Prince Siddhartha, who, as you will remember, is brought up and raised as a young man inside these gorgeous palaces that his father has given him. And yet, despite all of the satisfaction and well-being and so forth that he experiences therein, he feels somehow frustrated. He feels somehow that he's missing out on something. And so he arranges for his father to take him outside the palace walls. And on each occasion that he goes out, he comes across something that disturbs him profoundly. On the first instance, it is a person crippled with disease. On the second occasion, an aging person, someone very old and decrepit. And on the third occasion, a corpse. Now, on each time that he sees these things, he turns to his charioteer and says, "Is this the fate of all that lives? Will I have to die too?" And the charioteer has to say, "Yeah, of course you will, mate. Sorry, no way out." So the image, though, of course this is legendary. It's not actually in the suttas themselves, but it gives us in symbolic language something very close, I think, to this. We have, on the one hand, a sense of life that's contained, that's, as it were, hemmed in, walled in these great big palaces in which everything appears to be absolutely as it should be and fine and so on, and yet with an intimation that there is something more to life than just this. And yet when we, as it were, make that excursion into the wider domain of existence, we find something which is both on the one hand fascinating and on the other hand terrifying. So the Buddha's awakening in this first instance to the realities of sickness and aging and death is an awakening, as it were, to the tragic excess of human life itself. In other words, he doesn't just see a corpse or an old person or a sick person, but he is, as it were, transformed in his whole sense of what his life is by what these visions disclose. In other words, he realizes that life cannot be contained within the security, within the safety of conventional existence, that it evokes, it inspires questions about the nature of life itself that are both scary and at the same time utterly irresistible. Once one's life has been woken up to this sense of reality, it's very difficult to then, as it were, dismiss these things and just go back to living in one's palace or wherever one lives, one's condominium. And so the Buddhist sublime, one could argue, has its origins precisely in this experience of life as tragically excessive. Now, this doesn't lead the Buddha any more than it leads Keats into a kind of despair or into a kind of sort of subjective melancholy and dark and morbid brooding, but rather it provokes in him the need to actually and passionately follow where this question is going to lead. It gives him an inspiration to seek some kind of genuine response to these, to this, what the Chinese call the great matter of birth and death. I think in the Zen tradition we do find a particular conciseness in how the questions that provoke a spiritual life are deeply correlated to the kinds of responses that can be given to such questions. There is a famous passage in one of the Zen texts where it says, when there is great questioning, there can be great awakening. When there is little questioning, there can be little awakening. When there is no questioning, there can be no awakening. So in other words, the quality of insight, awakening, enlightenment, whatever we call it, that we may find, will always be correlated to the kind of questioning, the kind of inquiry that provokes us to pursue a path of understanding. If our questioning about life is primarily philosophical in nature, then that will, as it were, frame the possibility of, in most cases at least, a philosophical solution. If our question, however, like that of the Buddha, is one of existence, it's an existential questioning, then that will frame the possibility of a comparably existential response. And Zen in particular is very clear of this tension between these two things, the questioning and the response. Now, of course, the questioning, again, brings us back to Keats and his negative capability, but also it opens up the sense of the middle way. And again, I was saying this morning, but I will come back to it. The idea that when we are really held in a question or in a mystery, when it genuinely takes hold of our consciousness, we find ourselves in a state in which we can neither settle for this or that, yes or no, for any particular answer. To be in a state of questioning is necessarily to be in a state of unknowing. In a very simplistic sense, if I don't know where the bus station is in Hartford and I ask, where is the bus station? At the same moment as I question, I also acknowledge to myself that I don't know where the bus station is. Likewise, if we ask a Zen-like question like, what is this? Then if we do that with any genuineness or authenticity, we are implicitly acknowledging, I don't know what this is. The two go hand in hand. And so in this way, we find that questioning can likewise be seen as a kind of middle way, a kind of path, one in which we avoid the extremes of yes, of no, of is not, and so on, which becomes particularly developed in the poetry, the writings of Nagarjuna, where he seeks continuously to steer this course between the temptations to make either affirmative or negative statements about the nature of reality. Let me just read one of these as an example. I'll read this one called Essence. So this is my translation of I think it's chapter 15 from the Mula Majjhima Karikas, which I've translated as Essence. If my essence came from causes and conditions, it would have been constructed. Essences are neither contingent nor contrived. If I have no essence, how can you? What is other for me is for you your own. How can you not be yourself or someone else? Without something, there could be no nothing. Do not people say a thing becomes nothing when it changes into something else? You who behold somethings and nothings, yourselves and others, are blind to what the Buddha taught. Through understanding somethings and nothings, Gautama told Kachayana to relinquish being and nothingness. If I had an essence, I would never cease to be me. My nature could never be anything else. If I had no essence, whose nature would it be to be anything else? I am me, I will never not be. The longing for eternity. I used to be, I am not anymore, the cut of annihilation. The sage avoids being and nothingness. And there we have a very clear, maybe not entirely clear, but there we have, I think, a very clear evocation of this reluctance or this refusal to be drawn into one side of a dualism as opposed to another. And this, for Nagarjuna, becomes equivalent to the middle way itself. The middle way, of course, being not some kind of static path of belief and practice that we simply follow, but rather it is the opening up within our lives of an open and relatively selfless space in which we are exposed to the world in all of its ambiguity, its complexity, its glory, and are continuously, in every moment, standing or sitting on a cusp in which we are called forth to respond to that unfolding. And I think here we can begin to feel how some of these threads are coming together. That emptiness, the middle way, is not a static state at all, but it is rather a continuous kind of positioning or stationing ourselves within the flux of conditions, whereby we, as it were, like a juggler in a way, keep ourselves alive and moving without falling into the temptation of some kind of fixed position, which Nagarjuna calls fixation. And in fact, he speaks of the whole of the Buddha's teaching being about the easing of fixation. The easing of fixation. It's an expression that comes again and again and again. Now, what one might wonder do Keats and his friends have to say about this? Well, there are some wonderful passages in the letters which have a surprising resonance with this kind of sense of the world. The poetical character itself, writes Keats, it is not itself. It has no self. It is everything and nothing. It has no character. It enjoys light and shade. It lives in gusto, be it foul or fair, high or low, poor or rich, mean or elevated. It has as much delight in conceiving an Iago or as an Imogen. What shocks the virtuous philosopher delights the chameleon poet. A poet is the most unpoetical of anything in existence because he has no identity. He is continually in for and filling some other body. And then Keats talks in a very personal way. When I am in a room with people, if I'm ever free from speculating on creations in my own brain, then not myself goes home to myself, but the identity of everyone in the room begins to press in upon me so that I am in very little time annihilated. Not only among men, it would be the same in a nursery of children. I know not whether I make myself understood. Now, here we have, I think, a very, very clear, a very, very beautiful expression of this this selflessness, as it were, this self-annulling or self-abnegating quality of the poet, which enables him or her to be maximally responsive to the circumstances and the conditions of life that enable them to be seen and to be felt as mystery. Keats has another expression, the burden of the mystery. The burden of the mystery. Perhaps one of the passages in his letters that most strikingly parallels the Buddhist practice of contemplation is this in a letter of 1819. And again, he's talking about his friend Dilke. Now, Dilke seems to be a character who is, in a sense, stands for Keats, for everything that Keats does not want to be himself, a rather contented bourgeois kind of person. And yet, paradoxically, it's through Dilke, both, as we remember, 2 years earlier when he defines negative capabilities, through his conversations with Dilke that he arrives at some of his most profound insights. In other words, he needs Dilke as a kind of fall guy, as a sort of a straight man. He's talking about Dilke again. Dilke is a man who cannot feel he has any personal identity unless he has made up his mind about everything. And then he goes on. The only means of strengthening one's intellect is to make up one's mind about nothing, to let the mind be a thoroughfare for all thoughts, not a select party. Now, that line is extraordinary. And again, it sheds light on precisely this negative capability. And yet in a language that is entirely consonant with the sort of thing one would be taught, for example, in a Vipassana retreat, in a Buddhist retreat center. The idea to let the mind be a thoroughfare for all thoughts. In other words, to meditate in terms of simple awareness practice is not about literally emptying the mind and being kind of thoughtless, but rather learning to sustain a quality of attention in which whatever arises, be it sounds or smells or tastes or touches or thoughts or emotions or feelings or ideas, they are simply allowed to come and go without your becoming, as it were, preoccupied with them, captivated by them, and then inevitably spun off into some fantasy or series of associations. So the kind of awareness that is valued here is precisely that of allowing the mind to be a thoroughfare for all thoughts. Not is to make up one's mind about nothing. A kind of utter openness, which is not a denial of the content or the material of our lives, in which unfortunately, Buddhism is often presented this way. It's not a denial of these things, any more than emptiness is a denial of things. But it's rather a way of being with what life is continuously unfolding before our senses and our thoughts and our ideas. The temptation, of course, and this is in a sense the antithesis of what Nagarjuna and I guess Keats and the Buddha are interested in, is this very deep-seated attachment we have to locking on to something, a thought, an image, an opinion, a view about something, in order that we can get the impression, at least, that now we have something certain and secure. Now I've got something to believe in. Now I know what is the case. To, as it were, crystallize that thought that idea into something that, while providing an apparent sense of security, actually has the effect of closing ourselves down, of shutting ourselves off from the sheer richness of the contingency and the ambiguity of the world. So whether we are following the poetic injunctions of Keats, or whether we are following the soteriological injunctions of the Buddha or Nagarjuna, we are in both cases moving into a condition in which we allow what is to be in order that we may then respond to it, rather than maintaining our investment in whatever certainties are most attractive to us. And it's nearly 5 o'clock, so I think I might stop in a minute. And here's another passage from Keats. "Now it is more noble to sit like Jove than to fly like Mercury. Let us not therefore go hurrying about and collecting honeybee-like, buzzing here and there impatiently from a knowledge, of what is to be arrived at. But let us open our leaves like a flower and be passive and receptive, budding patiently under the eye of Apollo and taking hints from every noble insect that favors us with a visit." Again, a very similar kind of idea. It's not. It is certainly a quietening down, an opening, a passivity in some senses, and yet always qualified with the fact that this is about being able then to take hints from every noble insect that favors us with a visit. Now, metaphorically, we can see that likewise with a mind that is still and quiet is not shutting out the world, but is, as it were, actually opening up to the world in which, in such a way that we can be both more sensitive to and hopefully more responsive to what the world is, as it were, asking of us in that moment. So I'm going to stop there. I hope what I've said has been of some interest to you. I'd be very happy to take any questions or to hear whatever comments that you may have.
During discussion, Professor Batchelor was asked if there is any evidence of a knowledge of Buddhism among Keats's social circle.
But one can speculate, of course, but I think to be responsible without actually any hard evidence, I don't think there's really many grounds saying much about this. I mean, it's in the same territory then as the missing 12 years of Jesus, and Jesus went to India and learned Buddhism and stuff. I mean, it's a nice idea, and you can't disprove it, but there's no actual concrete evidence that anything remotely like that happened. So I don't think, I'm not at all aware in any of the literature I've read on the subject that Buddhist ideas had in any significant way filtered into Europe at this period. But on the other hand, does there have to be borrowing? I mean, it seems that, to me, it's an affirmation of what I read in the Buddhist text to find these same ideas occurring in very other contexts. There's also a danger too that we must be careful not to jump to conclusions that because X says empty here and Y says empty there, they both mean the same by the term. That's why I think Keats's letters are interesting, because you always read them in context. And you get a very vivid sense as you go through the letters of an emergent spirituality. And Keats himself, in one letter particularly, talks about his understanding of life as being what he calls the veil of the world as a veil of soul making, which is quite a well known expression. And he speculates that this might in fact be at the root of all of the great religious traditions. It's a kind of proto-universalism in a way, at least what he seems to be aspiring to. But the striking thing with Keats is that it's not just the negative capability idea that has Buddhist resonances, but also Keats' whole understanding of suffering in particular, that I think is even more markedly Buddhistic, if you wish. The way he describes the, it's a beautiful passage in one letter. His understanding of his one of his key terms is this term circumstance, which is very close to the Buddhist idea of conditions. He says, circumstances are like clouds continuously gathering and bursting. While we are laughing, the seed of some trouble is put into the wide arable land of events. While we are laughing, it sprouts, it grows, and suddenly bears a poison flower which we must pluck. Even so, we have leisure to reason on the misfortunes of our friends. Our own touch us too closely for words. Very few men have ever arrived at a complete disinterestedness of mind. Very few have been influenced by a pure desire for the benefit of others. Now, this is strange. I mean, it's you get in this last idea. This is an idea he develops again and again. Disinterestedness of mind, very similar to a kind of Buddhist equanimity, and which is coupled with this pure desire for the benefit of others, which is again an idea which is almost reads out of a contemporary Buddhist English translation of Buddhist text. And this extraordinary sensibility to the process of how conditions create the circumstances in which we live and are continuously deceiving us, as it were, generating experiences that we subsequently find very painful. Do you not see how necessary a world of pains and troubles is to school an intelligence and make it a soul? A place where the heart must feel and suffer in 1,000 diverse ways, and so on. I mean, there's loads of material here in which, I mean, what's wonderful about Keats is that there is this extraordinary sensibility, which is both, on the one hand, a reflection on his own understanding of poetry, but also something which for him is utterly inseparable from his whole relationship to being human, to living. Living a true and real life.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.